We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by Sublime Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, 1st Canto, 19th Chapter, 29th Text.
Shyamam,
Shyamam,
Sarapidya,
Sarapidya,
Payonga,
Vashnya,
Srinam, Manojam,
Sa Vishnu Rato Titaya Agataya tasmai saparyam shirasa jaharo tatoni vritta yadudatriyor bakan hasane sapavivesha bujita. Sa, Yati, Vishnurata, Maharaj Parikshita, was always protected by Lord Vishnu. Atitaye, to become a guest. You know that word, Atiti, Narayan, means the uninvited guest. Agataya, one who arrived there. Tasmai, unto him. Sapayam, with the whole body. Shirasa, with bowed head. I guess we can say these all together. Ajahara, offered obeisances. Thereafter. Nibrita. Cease. He. Certainly. Abhuta. That's intelligent. Striya. Women. Abhaka. Boys. Mahasane. Exalted. Seat. Now, I guess we have Mahasana. So, Asana is a seat. Maha means great, exalted seat. And another word that we should all know. Abuddha. Buddha means intelligence, right? And Ah means not or without. So, less intelligent. Sa. He. Ubhavivesha. Sat down. Pujita, being respected. Another word, puja, worship, respect. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Maharaj Parikshit, who is also known as Vishnurata, one who is always protected by Vishnu, bowed his head to receive the chief guest, Shukadeva Goswami. At that time, all the ignorant women and boys ceased following Srila Shukadeva. Receiving respect from all, Shukadeva Goswami took his exalted seat. That's another word we know, rat. I guess it comes from raka, means to protect. Mari Krishna Raki Ke Raki Krishna Mari Ke. We'll repeat then. Maharaj Parikit, who is also known as Vishnu Rata, one who is always protected by Vishnu, bowed his head to receive the chief guest, Shukadeva Goswami. At that time, all the ignorant women and boys ceased following Srila Shukadeva. Receiving respect from all, Shukadeva Goswami took his exalted seat. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. On Shukadeva Goswami's arrival at the meeting, everyone except Srila Vyasadeva, Narada, and a few others stood up, and Maharaj Parikshit, who was glad to receive a great devotee of the Lord, bowed down before him with all the limbs of his body. Shukadeva Goswami also exchanged the greetings and reception by embrace, shaking of hands, nodding, and bowing down, especially before his father and Narada Muni. Thus he was offered the presidential seat in the meeting. When he was so received by the king and sages, the street boys and less intelligent women who followed him were struck with wonder and fear. So they retired from their frivolous activities, and everything was full of gravity and calm. Om Gyanatvinda Tegananjana Talakaya Chakturumri Samjaymantasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapanantikam. People gravitate to temples and places of pilgrimage in the world to become purified. A lot of people come to this temple to become purified, and they go to places of pilgrimage in Vrindavan or Tirupati or Madurai or many other places, Puri, sacred places, to become purified. Unfortunately, In the process, they leave their sinful reactions in those places. And those places tend to become like toxic waste dumps of the consciousness, where people are leaving all their sinful reactions behind. So it's stated in the Bhagavatam that these places of pilgrimage, they get purified and repurified by saintly persons who go to visit there. And we're particularly fortunate that Srila Prabhupada himself came to purify places like this. There's a phrase, holy ground. It's very trite and hackneyed phrase, but all the places we can say where we know that great saints like Srila Prabhupada walked became purified and became like holy ground. So a place of a temple or a deity is not necessarily a purified place unless it is purified and repurified by the footsteps of great holy sages who, as the Bhagavatam states, purify those places, make them pure, and make them places where we can go and become purified. It is natural that human beings want to become purified. There's some interesting statements the Prabhupada makes. I'm going to jump in a little bit. Also, this morning I want to read something to you that I read yesterday, which I found very interesting. It's a little on the sociological side, not like yesterday's presentation, but it's a look at ISKCON movement in its particular stage of development. And it was written by a professor named Tom Hopkins. Some of you remember him from the Hare Krishna movie film. I think it was called The World of Hare Krishna or something like that. But he talks a little about how Prabhupada was functioning and how in his experience with devotees wasn't exactly the same as Srila Prabhupada, because they didn't embrace the same values, or they didn't grasp fully the same values that Prabhupada did, or have the same qualities. So I'm going to read something that he wrote very recently, within a few weeks. Prabhupada writes that, a very interesting statement, it's in the purport to the 31st verse of this chapter. He says, before Maharaj Parikshit, he recited, meaning Sukadeva Goswami, Srimad Bhagavatam. Before Maharaj Parikshit, he recited Srimad Bhagavatam and answered the questions of Maharaj Parikshit unhesitatingly. This was said to be the first time he spoke Srimad Bhagavatam. And thus both master and disciple got salvation. Now we understand that Sukadeva Goswami is already liberated. But according to this statement, both the master and the disciple got salvation by the exchange that took place, by hearing and answering questions. So the indication here is that the speaker is very enthused when good questions are asked. When the hearer is very sincere and wants to hear, asks good questions, the person has to delve very deeply, the speaker, into its Shravanam, Kirtanam, and Smaranam, right? Shravanam is the hearing, Kirtanam is the speaking, and Smaranam is remembering. So for one who engages in the Kirtan or the speaking process, when the hearing process is very alert, very acute, then the Kirtan process becomes more and more enlightened, and the Smaranam process, the remembering process, becomes more and more penetrating. So one who speaks will penetrate more deeply into hearing. So Maharaj Parikshit asked very wonderful questions. He was very rapt in his attention. And the speaker, Sukadeva Goswami, was very keen to not only explain the Bhagavatam, but to explain it, as we were reading yesterday, in such a manner that it would liberate the hearer. So he went very deep into the Bhagavatam and not only recited it, but explained it according to the desire of the hearer. And Prabhupada says something else which is interesting. I'm jumping in a little bit, but we'll go back into these verses. The 35th verse of this chapter says that Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead who is very dear to the sons of King Pandu has accepted me as one of those relatives just to please his great cousins and brothers. This is, of course, Maharaj Purit speaking. So, towards the end of the purport, Prabhupada writes this. The Lord is so kind that he gives all protection to the family members of his devotee. And thus the devotee has no need to bother about his family members, even if one leaves such family members aside to discharge devotional service. Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers were the sons of Kunti, the paternal aunt of Lord Krishna, and Maharaj Parikit admits the patronage of Lord Krishna because of his being the only grandson of the great Pandavas. We were watching the video of Prabhupada yesterday or the day before, and the theme kept coming up about how he wasn't going to drink tea, he wasn't going to compromise. I think most of you saw that one. And then when he wants his wife to take initiation, she states that she has to have tea. Very important for her to have tea. And in the end, of course, we know that Prabhupada takes sannyas, and it's mainly over this tea issue. She continues to want to drink tea, even though it's a very seemingly insignificant thing. Later, when Prabhupada came to the West, he said that he kept dreaming that his Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, was calling him away to take sannyas. Years before, he'd even thought of it, and he was, in his own words, horrified at the prospect of having to leave his family members and take sannyas. However, when he came to Second Avenue, when he was ensconced in that temple, and many Americans began to come there, he said on one day, it was near the appearance day, the spiritual master, he said that he was very horrified at the prospect of having to leave everything behind to take sannyas, and especially he was very attached to his children. But then he said, but now I have more children. I have more, not only more children, but more caring children, hundreds, instead of the three or four of my own biological or blood relatives. I don't know the exact words he used. But he said that my point is that whoever takes shelter of Krishna is not the loser. Even though it appears we are giving up so many things that are very near and dear to us, ultimately we will succeed and we will be satisfied, we will be happy, we will be cared for, will be looked after, as we were reading in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Part of surrendering to Krishna is always feeling protected by Krishna. So, as it is stated in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, family members are like fallible soldiers. They're very important to us, just like all the soldiers that surround us when we go into battle. But if those soldiers are stricken or cut down, we can't do anything. We have to continue to move on. So, and it is also stated in the seventh canto and other sections of the Srimad Bhagavatam that when one becomes a devotee, when one becomes dedicated to devotional service fully and solely, fully, then one's ancestors and one's, what is it called, progeny or future, I can't think of the word, they're all liberated. For generations, 10 generations, 12 generations, 50 generations, 100 generations, Prabhupada says in different places. So Krishna is very, very kind. And what was Prahlad Maharaj's desire when he was asked to state anything he wished? It was like, you know, rubbing the magic lamp. He could have anything. Lord Srimad was right there before him and said, whatever you wish, I'll give you. You can have it. He said, I don't want anything, nothing. Nothing for myself. I only want that you should liberate my father. His father, who tried to murder him in so many horrendous ways, threw him into the pit of snakes, into boiling oil off a cliff, into the pit of demons and snakes, and tried in so many ways. He only wanted that his father should liberate. That's the great compassion of the devotee. So, everything is taken care of by one who surrenders to Krishna. And of course, the surrendering process is not a simple or easy process. We were reading about the six points of surrender. To always accept things favorable, to reject things unfavorable, to always feel dependent upon Krishna's mercies, to always be very meek and humble, to always be dependent on Krishna's mercy, and to always feel protected by Krishna. These are very important things and very difficult things to achieve, to always know what to accept and what to reject. But nevertheless, this is the process of Sharanagati, or surrender. Very, very difficult. So Maharaj prayed because he was given a sign. He knew he only had a few more days to live. He was very receptive. And he's a symbolic of hearing very attentively, very rapidly, because we all know that we have to die, but we forget. And in this consciousness, to know that there's nothing else left, that I have to leave this material world at a certain point, better, he was thinking, now than never, sooner than never, better sooner than never. He began to hear with great, great attention. So I'm going to read something that might take a while, and I don't want to belabor the class and go late like I did yesterday. So I'm going to read what Dr. Hopkins wrote about the history of the Hare Krishna movement, and we can have some time for questions afterwards. This is about to be published in the ISKCON Communications Journal. That's why I have an advanced copy of it. This journal, I think, do you get it here? The journal comes out twice a year? Maybe not. Yeah, there was a very controversial article by Rick Pritchard about child abuse in the last one. So this is not so controversial, but it's about the history of ISKCON. Now there's two things that many people say are important. And one is to define what we mean by a member of ISKCON, which we haven't done. Is that someone who's initiated, or someone who's a life member? Is anyone who thinks I'm a member? And then what is the history of the Hare Krishna movement, and how does that impact on our philosophy, our lifestyle, our study of what Prabhupada is and our philosophy. So this article is called Why Should ISKCON Study Its Own History? By Professor Tom Hopkins, who is now working for the Institute of Vaishnava and Hindu Studies in Oxford. It's run by Sharma Tarishi and several devotees who work there. They also have two nights a week preaching programs. So it's a combination of a study center and an ISKCON temple. ISKCON's institutional history is now a little more than 30 years old, if we count A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami's arrival in America as his starting point. Within this time period, roughly a generation long, we can see two clear stages. The dozen years of dramatic success and worldwide expansion during Prabhupada's lifetime, and the more ambiguous period of both successes and problems since his departure in 1977. In the first of these stages, the seed of ISKCON was planted and a young and vigorous seedling grew under Prabhupada's personal care. In the second stage, his followers have struggled to cultivate and tend the growing plant that has propagated throughout the world during the last two decades. Not surprisingly, it is this first stage, the period of Prabhupada's personal leadership and ISKCON's rapid growth, that has received the greatest attention from ISKCON members over the years. A wonderful biography of Prabhupada has been written. Journals of some of his early disciples have been published, and formal talks and even his informal conversations have been collected in several multi-volume series, and archives have been established to preserve and publish his works in various media. At this juncture, we probably know more about Prabhupada's life and works and teachings than we do about the founder of any religious movement in history. Certainly, more than we do with Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, or even Chaitanya himself. The second stage of ISKCON's history is a very different matter. It is, for one thing, a much more complex story to deal with. Instead of a single major factor to follow the spotlight of attention, there are many different players acting at once in theaters around the world. The drama being played, moreover, is not as unrelievably joyous as that of the earlier years. There are shadows on the stage, dark passages in the story, and not a few examples of human frailty. There is no longer an assumption that nothing can go wrong. The joyous first act gives way to an often painful series of leadership problems, organizational disputes, and internal conflicts, and the clouds of mundane human affairs and human weaknesses often obscure the sun of Prabhupada's infallible grace. There is a natural tendency, therefore, to prefer to replay the first act and avoid looking too carefully at what follows after the curtain closes on Prabhupada's departure. Yet however reasonable this may be, the avoidance of the more recent past in favor of the halcyon days of old has had serious consequences for ISKCON's self-understanding. It is clearly more pleasant to recall the days with Prabhupada, and it is necessary to do so to keep him always at the center of ISKCON's life. It is now more than 20 years since his passing, however, and that is nearly two-thirds of ISKCON's total lifespan. Many important decisions have been made during that period, many changes have occurred, and many new developments have taken place. Some of what has happened has been problematic, and some has been painful, but much of it has been very positive. Most importantly, ISKCON has survived a very difficult stage in its development and is now healthier than it has been for many years. How has this happened? What went wrong in the past and what responses were made that restored ISKCON's health? Without understanding these issues, it will be hard to preserve that healthy condition for the future. ISKCON is certainly not alone in facing such problems of self-understanding. Every major religious tradition has had to deal with the transition from its origins and founding figure to the more problem-fraught period of new leadership and institutional development. Buddhism faced this problem when the Buddha died, forcing his followers to find new ways to preserve his teachings and maintain the monastic community he had founded. The transition was not easy, as we learn from the Buddhist texts produced over the next few centuries. But centuries of hard work and self-examination finally paid off. Scriptures were created to set forth the Buddhist teachings and their implications. Institutions were established to maintain monastic discipline and serve the needs of the householders, and new texts were written to aid Buddhist self-understanding of how all this had come about. 25 centuries later, this early effort is still the foundation of Buddhist life and practice. A better known and even more relevant example is Christianity, which faced internal conflicts even before anything called Christianity existed. Jesus' disciples were clearly confused about who he was and what his teachings meant. They quarreled among themselves about the privileges they might gain when he came to power. And ultimately, one of them, the infamous Judas, betrayed Jesus to the Roman authorities. Peter, Jesus' favorite disciple, and quote, the rock, end quote, on whom the later church would stand, twice denied that he knew the arrest of Jesus or had ever followed him. And all of Jesus' disciples believed that the story had ended when he died on the cross. Even after the resurrection, not all of Jesus' closest followers were able to accept what had occurred, and the early emerging community of Christians, or Nazarenes, struggled to understand what had happened and what its consequences might be. A generation later, as we know from the Apostle Paul's New Testament epistles to young churches, there was widespread disagreement among Christian communities about matters of fundamental faith and practice. Much of Paul's career, some 30 or more years after the death of Jesus, was spent on doctrinal, ritual, and organizational disputes that threatened to tear the new church apart. How do we know about these problems in Buddhism and Christianity? Because both religious traditions believed it was important to face the disputes that had beset their early years, describe the conflicts openly, and show how they had been resolved. The same is true of Islam, where the death of the Prophet ushered in a dispute about a successor that has affected Muslim history down to the present day. Efforts to preserve the words of Muhammad have, moreover, led to numerous questions about which words were truly his and when they had been uttered, and witnesses called to resolve the disputes disagreed on the time and circumstances of many sayings. Yet despite the anguish caused by such fundamental disputes and by the sometimes dubious behavior of those involved, the early Muslim chroniclers believed it was essential to preserve a record of what had happened. There is no doubt about the success of these three great world traditions. Buddhism is now well into its third millennium. Christianity is approaching the end of its second millennium, and Islam is still expanding into new areas more than 13 centuries after Muhammad's death. Clearly, they have prospered over the years despite their difficult beginnings. It would be simplistic to credit their historical awareness for all their successes, but awareness of their early problems was certainly a factor in overcoming later challenges. One does not learn how to resolve problems if one denies them. And, in the oft-repeated maxim, those who ignore the past are doomed to repeat it. Facing one's problems does not magically remove them, of course, but it provides the opportunity to learn and grow stronger through a better understanding of the past and a greater awareness of present needs and possibilities. ISKCON as a continuation of Chaitanya Vaishnavism is not a new religion, but ISKCON as an institution is now still in the first generation of Prabhupada's early disciples, roughly the same point in time when Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam had to decide how to deal with their initial crises. It is natural that all newly founded religions would face such decisions at about the same time. The memory of the founder is still strong, but those who knew him personally are getting older, and many new members never met him. New leadership has emerged, and their role vis-a-vis the founder is still unclear in terms of the succession of authority. Who should be in charge now? What is his or her right, or perhaps mandate, to initiate new developments in changing circumstances? The community of faithful has grown and faces new challenges. New institutions and new organizational structures are needed, and new opportunities can only be cultivated with new approaches. But who is to make the needed decisions? And how can they be both faithful to the founder's teachings and was permanently divided over the issue of leadership succession after the prophet's death. What is clear, however, is that these religions would never have moved beyond the point of crisis if the questions had been ignored or suppressed. It is hard to face internal conflicts and challenges openly and boldly, but it is deadly not to face them. ISKCON is very fortunate in this situation compared to most other religions. Most obviously, ISKCON possesses a body of its founder's teachings that far surpasses that of any religious movement before modern times. Almost every word that Prabhupada spoke was recorded on the spot, and everything he wrote has been published. Buddhists, by contrast, struggled for generations to remember, collect, and transmit over 40 years of the Buddha's teachings orally, with a further lapse of several centuries before they were first written down. Early Christianity faced another kind of challenge, because Jesus taught a group of newly recruited disciples for only a few short years before his crucifixion. Their differing backgrounds and often conflicting agendas affected how they remembered what he had said, when or where he had said it, and what his sayings meant. The result was three different official accounts of his life and ministry, the three so-called synoptic gospels ascribed to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and a fourth account, the Gospel of John, which disagrees with the synoptics in its portrayal of Jesus' life and teachings. Early Muslims faced a somewhat different set of problems after Muhammad's death. His ministry and revelations were soon codified in the Quran with little dissension. The leadership of the Muslim community was almost immediately in question. At issue, among other things, was the content and meaning of what Muhammad had said on different occasions about succession to his leadership, whom he most trusted to carry out his wishes, and how the community should conduct itself in matters of morality and law. After long debate, Muslims decided to accept alternative versions or interpretations of Muhammad's sayings, the Hadith, and to legitimate several separate schools of law with different principles of authority. What these examples from Buddhist, Christian, and Muslim history show is that the period after the death of a founder is critical in a religious movement. The movement's continuing life is at stake at this point, because the overriding question is whether it can make a successful transition from the founder's charismatic leadership into an institutional form that will preserve the faith over time. Central to this process, as these examples also show, is preserving the message and example of the founder in as many ways as possible. Buddhists did this by collecting, editing, and passing on orally all of the teachings of the Buddha that anyone could remember, along with his rules and directions for the monastic community. Christians did it by preserving Jesus' teachings in a collection of, quote, sayings, end quote, that eventually found their way into narratives of Jesus' life, the three synoptic gospels, and the Gospel of John, which became the foundation documents for Christian faith and practice. Muslims did it by memorizing the Quran, the verbatim record of Muhammad's vision and revelations, and by collecting soon after the Prophet's death all the various versions of his conversations with his followers, the so-called Hadith, or tradition. ISKCON, as noted earlier, has already completed this stage of collecting its founder's teaching well ahead of schedule, thanks in part to modern technology, but thanks also to the foresight of Prabhupada's initial followers who started recording his words and music almost from the beginning of his mission. There are no significant questions in his case about what he said and where he said it, as there clearly are in other religions. His teachings have been published in books, magazines, records, videotapes, and CD-ROMs, and are accessible to anyone who wants to read, see, or hear them. By analogy with other religions, the canonical scriptures of ISKCON have been established, and the vital first stage in the transition has been successfully completed. If we look further at other religions, however, we realize that this is only the start of a long-term process. Founders are essential to convey their personal example directly to their followers or disciples, and scriptures are necessary to preserve the founders' teachings for later generations. Without a living tradition, however, both become antiquities. It is too soon now to say that this has happened to Prabhupada and his teachings, but ISKCON still has a direct connection to Prabhupada through present disciples who were with him for many years. There is a tendency in ISKCON today, however, to look on Prabhupada and his teachings as a source of proof text for ad hoc policies and decisions, rather than try to understand him and the tradition in which he stood more systematically. In what may seem a paradoxical way, it may be necessary to pay less attention to specific statements that Prabhupada made in order to preserve the vitality of what he stood for. Prabhupada himself was constantly changing, not in his essential beliefs and devotional relation to Krishna, but in the decisions he made to meet new circumstances and take advantage of new opportunities. Prabhupada was a living human devotee, and it was his supreme devotional humanness that gave life to ISKCON, rather than any one or even the whole body of his teachings. Nevertheless, it is his teachings and the memory of his living presence in ISKCON. That ISKCON now has to rely upon, along with, and he would certainly be the first to say this, the guidance of Krishna, the divine Godhead. How does one use these properly to keep ISKCON a vital tradition? The answer certainly is not to use them in bits and pieces to support decisions made for more materialistic or egocentric reasons. It is rather to approach Prabhupada, his teachings, and the tradition in which he stood, the tradition of Chaitanya Vaishnavism, as mediated through earlier scriptures and the teachings of Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, in a more systematic manner to provide a dialogue with the past in behalf of the future, on behalf, I think he means, of the future. The name for such a systematic approach is theology, supplemented by what Christians have long called church history. History, that is to say, which assumes the divine basis for the institutions and practices of the religious community, but nonetheless undertakes to study them as a part of human history. This is not to diminish the importance of the scriptures, the founder, or the continuing divine guidance, but rather to take them all with the utmost seriousness as a necessary foundation for the community's ongoing religious life. The purpose of theology and church history, or in this case, ISKCON history, is rather to maintain a continuous check of the present against the core values and essential doctrines of the larger tradition and the spirit of the founder. It is, in other words, to keep the bright light of trained and devout attention on the way the Lord's human agents are presenting his teachings and managing his affairs. ISKCON is now in a position to undertake such an effort, and needs to do so while Prabhupada's influence is still so powerful in living memory. The effort to create a theological tradition within ISKCON has in fact already started, although there is so far no solid institutional base to provide theological training and maintain an active theological community. The Institute for Vaishnava Studies is trying to develop such a base in the USA, however, and the Center for Vaishnava and Hindu Studies is working to establish a scholarly base at Oxford that could contribute to this effort. There is widespread, if not unanimous, support within ISKCON for developing a community of scholar devotees who could take on the theological task for the movement, and this support should increase as more and more devotees gain the necessary academic training. The study of ISKCON's history, however, has hardly begun with ISKCON itself. Numerous scholars outside ISKCON have studied its history, and some have done excellent work, but non-devotees have neither the personal understanding nor the factual information to carry out a balanced study of ISKCON's institutional history. This task awaits devotees who have the devotion, who have the historical training and the institutional support to carry out what will be, even at this early stage of ISKCON's development, a difficult and time-consuming job of collecting the worldwide data of ISKCON's expansion and evolution, organizing it systematically, and trying for the first time to provide a comprehensive understanding of ISKCON's history. In the process, if the job is well done, many of ISKCON's internal problems, the skeletons in its closet, as it were, will be made more evident. But this is why institutional history must be done. and why it should be done by devotees who respect the movement and its members even as they reveal their defects along with their strengths. ISKCON should study its own history, this is to say, because it needs to do so for its own health and self-understanding. This is not a job to leave to outsiders. Although they may provide scholarly advice, it is a family job to be done by devotees trained for the task and conscious of the movement's needs as well as the obligations of scholarship. ISKCON's history over the past three decades must be studied with constant reference to what it could be and what it should be on the basis of Prabhupada's fundamental principles, so that strengths can be recognized and built upon, and mistakes can be corrected before they cause future harm. This history must also recognize the changing circumstances within which ISKCON is operating, and in comparison with the past, such as the presence of a worldwide Hindu diaspora that has given ISKCON a new ministry to Hindus abroad. And it must be serious, sustained, and a central part of ISKCON's own program of self-examination and self-improvement. Can this be done? Certainly it can, if there is the will to do it and the support within ISKCON to get it started. But it will take time and commitment to put in place the needed theological and historical resources, both human and material. In the meantime, ISKCON members everywhere should begin thinking about what might aid the process, especially what records, documentation, personal accounts, and local histories are available to fill in the historical record. Much valuable data has no doubt been lost over the years, but devotees should at least now begin to pay more careful attention to preserving the record of the past. It is glorious, a glorious past, and it needs to be studied with all the evidence possible, warts and all, ISKCON is to remain worthy of Prabhupada's faith in his future. So, that's a perspective from a person who is very involved in working with devotees and is a very staunch well-wisher of Prabhupada's movement, and some important insights have issued forth from that. Certainly a number of our devotees are studying, becoming qualified to put together the kind of systematic perspectives that he talks about here. And it will be very important for the future. So, I have a few minutes left, I guess. Krishna will leave the time deeper. To ask questions or give some thoughts on these matters.
It's interesting the point that you made about how devotees use Prabhupada's words as proof text. Mm-hmm. Now, like, a lot of times there's arguments on one or two words here and there, and devotees try to beat each other up on some technical point, but they don't look behind the issue and see how it really affects people in their life and consequences.
Yeah. Prabhupada even wrote letters saying that he appreciates devotees who understand the inner meaning of his teachings. So, by selective quoting and taking certain words out of context to back a particular issue may be very unproductive, could even prove very fatal part of, as you said, the result in people getting in unnecessary arguments. So it does require more thoroughgoing study of the whole notion, and as he was pointing out, that Prabhupada never compromised, as we were reading yesterday, the original text should never know the novel meaning of the original text. New meaning should be screwed out of the text. It should remain constant and pure and perfect, but at the same time, according to time, place, and circumstances, as he pointed out, Prabhupada said different things at different times, according and he appeared to be changing externally, because the historical and cultural context do change, but the essential philosophy doesn't change. So, this is an important insight. Yeah.
Another point, this is my opinion, so you can please feel free to comment, but it seems that a lot of times devotees try to just say, well, this is the right understanding from the Shastra, and you just have to accept it, and this is all there is to it, and the black and white type of thing, without realizing that the reason why a lot of, well, this is just my opinion, so you can please feel free to comment, but it seems that a lot of times devotees try to just say, well, this is the right understanding from the Shastra, and you just have to accept it, and this is all there is to it, and the black and white type of thing, without realizing that reason why a lot of ideas might come up that might actually be contradictory to the scriptures is because there's some sort of lacking or an emotional need that the people feel. Like, to be more specific, like if you take the replica shed, you could look at that and say, well, Prabhupada never said that it's not in his books anywhere, therefore just forget this whole philosophy and this is the right way to understand it, and if you don't accept this and just get out, you're useless. Or another way of looking at it is trying to understand, well, why is it that they feel the need to create this philosophy? What's the underlying emotional or sort of sociological cause for it, and dealing with the root cause rather than trying to sort of deal with the superficial problem.
There's just sort of a hardcore people who will never be changed, and their thought is that any initiation that took place since Prabhupada's passing is invalid, and that people only have the right to initiate on behalf of Prabhupada as a functionary, religious functionaries. There are such persons who probably won't change. What percentage they are of the whole Rithvik movement is difficult to say. Those may be the hardcore, you might say, hard Rithviks. And then there's the soft Rithviks who want Prabhupada to be more at the center of things and don't necessarily deny initiations. And a number of them could become more unrificated, so to speak, and become part of the standard procedures of ISKCON. And I'm sure a lot of them will. What percentage it will be, it's hard to say. But the great upsurge of Rithvikism, or the resurgence of it, has probably come about because some of Prabhupada's disciples feel that some of the gurus in ISKCON have too big of a profile and they're not putting Prabhupada in the center. And so they have started a movement that feels that Prabhupada has been sort of, you know, pushed aside in favor of gurus who want to be the center of things. So guru reform is very much on the cards coming up, and there was the Zonacharya issue, and that sort of lost its momentum. It was diffused really by a series of articles and behaviors and papers, resolutions, and as it's kind of rising up to the surface again, percolating upward, I'm sure there will be further reform that takes place over the next few years as part of this whole historical view of ISKCON and what Prabhupada wanted. It's interesting that a lot of the Rithvikism movement is now not calling itself Rithvikism movement, it's calling itself ISKCON reform movement, because they don't really, a lot of them don't really believe in Rithvikism, which means that no one can initiate except on behalf of Prabhupada. It doesn't count anymore. So that's an indication that many of a lot of the impetus for this movement is not really based upon a difference in core philosophy, but a difference in more of a cultural, historic way in which the philosophy is applied. So that's a very interesting comment to look behind the matter. Of course, all approaches will probably be, and I think are, to be necessary. There needs to be some very strong refutation, maybe point by point, of rigid philosophy or papers. There needs to be kind of a simple refutation, that not everyone's going to read the point-by-point detailed refutation. And there also needs to be some very strong, of course they're already existing, maybe there needs to be further strengthening of the fact that those who are convinced that such a philosophy of Rithvikism exists have no place in the ISKCON movement. So all approaches are actually relevant and important to exist, because there are different gradations of commitment to this type of thing.
It seems that many times these resolutions passed to establish certain things, but nothing seems to change very much, even though there's the resolutions passed, given the so-called right understanding.
Yeah.
It kind of continues on as it was, and that doesn't seem to get to the root of the real problem.
Yeah, because enlightened leadership or spiritual leadership is one in which they're not... whatever is said is done, it's followed through, and it's everyone is aware of it, and so on. So, reform not only in the guru issues, but in the leadership issues is also very much necessary in all the parts as part of the historical evolution that has gone. there needs to be a constitution, there needs to be more enlightened leadership, there needs to be a deeper understanding of institutional practices of administration and so on. That's all part of this historical evolution. And as this the doctor of history, I think he is, states that that despite all these things, that the movement is still in a very good, healthy state because there's a strong commitment to the philosophy of it and what we know of Prabhupada. You had a question?
I was just going to ask that, is it this group that we'll be dealing with drawing up the constitution, it seems to be more of an objective body that the centers are in the GDC. This group that had more influence on the future of society.
Constitution and all sorts of social issues are being worked on by people that aren't part of the GBC because they can have more time on their hands, and in many ways, therefore, they can be more objective. Let's say. So.
Breakfast today. It's very late breakfast.
Oh, it's time to
see.
What's
that?
9:15.
9:15. Oh, we can get some more food today. Actually, I have to leave by 8:30, but we can go another 10 minutes or so.
All right.
Yeah.
No, it's Krishna. I'm having Krishna class. It's one of the ones. Why is it in our society that people actually don't feel protected by Krishna? Krishna actually states many times that I'll protect that. One of the common things you hear all the time. I don't feel protected, I don't feel why.
Yeah.
But which defeats the very purpose of our whole society.
Mm-hmm. The idea of protection in Sharanagati or surrender is there that despite what happens, we should always feel that Krishna is protecting them. And as Kalsavar is pointing out, many of our members are not only feeling unprotected, but they're actually not protected. And the cases of child abuse are an indication that that was very much the case. It wasn't just a thought, it wasn't just a feeling of an individual, but there was a very serious section of our society that wasn't getting proper protection. And probably still there are sections of our society that are not getting proper protection. And it's due to many reasons. Part of it is not seeing the proper historical context. Part of it is this kind of selective quoting, like, well, Krishna will protect you. It's there, you know. My devotee will never be one question, and we can find so many quotes from all the Shastras and the Prabhupada said that you're going to be protected. If you don't feel protected, you're a minor. You know? I mean, that's a very simplistic way to reinforce people's feeling about being not protected and to reinforce the non-protection of people. I'm not saying it's because we're here, but I always cite it. I mean, on numerous occasions I've cited the Christ Church Temple as when I visited there as what I call the high trust culture, because I think in that place, of course, maybe you know better than I, it's not true, but there was the feeling that people were protected because the president's office wasn't locked, his book cabinets weren't locked, and it was a very unusual situation because where I grew up in ISKCON, everything was kind of locked, and you know, it wasn't so, people didn't trust each other so much. The idea is of course found in many of Prabhupada's teachings and in the original seven principles of why ISKCON is that the members of society should come closer together, which means they should form a family. There should be a kind of unity in diversity. That there should be a sense of protecting. And Prabhupada once said that we shouldn't be surprised by how many people leave ISKCON, but by how many people stay in ISKCON. So the whole idea of growth. It can be considered exponential, and if we look at the charts that Solanas Chaitanya sometimes produces, we have this geometric progression that if we have our anamahatas growing in the right way, there will be 10, and then it will be 100, and then there will be 1,000, and 20,000, and 100 million, and so on. But in 10 years, there will be hundreds of millions of devotees. But within that, he also makes it very clear that unless every devotee is cared for very well and feels very cared for, is actually cared for, then that progression won't happen because it's all based upon the idea that I'm fully cared for and fully protected. Now, for a lot of us, the idea of protection, especially in men, I suppose, is we don't see it as an issue. We think that people who think they have to be protected are just cowards, or they're not understanding the philosophy, or they're not really taking shelter of Krishna. But it's actually the duty we find it in the scriptures, and I'm quoting selectively, but I'm talking about things that are throughout the scriptures. We say, and we find in the fifth canon, for example, that one should not even consider being a parent or a demigod or a spiritual master, a father, a mother, a protector, a teacher, unless one can deliver one's dependence from death. And that means affection. That means protection. There's an article written in For Back to Godhead by a devotee who had this notion that her child should be more surrendered. Child in Gurukul of about 7 or 8. And whenever she said, well, you don't hug me, you don't spend any time with me, she said, well, you gotta be more surrendered. You just gotta take shelter of Krishna. Krishna will protect you. So one day while the mother was out milking cows, which was her habit in Gita Nagari, she wasn't getting very much milk. And this went on for several days, and she complained to the person that was in charge of the goshala, you know, this cow's beautiful, big cow, they're not giving much milk. What did they do? And he said, well, you should have to talk to the cows. You know, they're not just blind robotic automatons. They're living entities, and you got to talk to them and make them feel comfortable, and then they'll start giving more milk. So she did that, and the cows started giving more milk, and consistently. And then she thought, well, yeah, that cow's feeling some affection for me. So then she thought, I'll apply this to my child. And she started spending more time with her child and telling her that she loved her and that doing seemingly mundane things with her. And the child began to be a better performer in the group, began to understand the philosophy better, began to be a better devotee, began to be more surrendered and felt more protected from Krishna. So this is a very common fallacy that we all experience, that we just think that we can, you know, race on ahead and leave everything behind, and Krishna's going to protect everybody. But we have a society that we have a lot of unprotected people that are either weaker than we are, that are younger than we are, that are in need of nurturing. All of us need that. We all need. Bhakti Kirtan Raj has been criticized sometimes because he uses the word love so much. But we actually all need it. I mean, our affection, whatever we want to call it. And it's very true what he's saying, that sambandha, which means relationships, is the one of the places where we're very, very weak. Because in every endeavor, in everything we do, in Krishna consciousness, to spread the movement or to become better devotees, there's a relationship factor that's very important, that we very often tend to overlook or leave behind. And we just think that it's, you know, we'll get it from Prabhupada, we'll get it from Krishna. But this affection that we're getting from Prabhupada and from Krishna is supposed to flow through us to everyone else. It's not just supposed to be there between us and Krishna, but it's supposed to be like the great flood of love of God. It's like a great river that raises all the boats. It's supposed to be something that people feel. They want to join Krishna consciousness, or they will want to join and be part of a movement where they feel that they're part of the team, part of the family, and they feel they're protected. And what are they being protected from? They're being protected from the onslaughts of the lower modes of nature. They're being protected from maya, which is constantly encroaching upon us and trying to draw us away and to get us into the spirit of enjoyment. And that was the great fear of even Prahlada Maharaj. He said, I'm not afraid of even the Sringadeva. All the demigods were pushing him forward because they were afraid of the very fearsome features, the very horrible visage of this, you know, lion feature of the Lord. But he said, I'm not afraid of anything but the material nature is very fearful. And I want you to liberate my father. And even Prabhupada himself said that. He said, he told one of his disciples, Jivananda in Germany, I want you to pray for me. He said, Prabhupada, you're pure. What can I say? What can I do? How can I pray for you? And he said, I want you to pray that I'll never fall down. Of course, Prabhupada will never fall down, but he was citing the fact that he wanted prayers to protect him from Maya, because Maya is so strong. So it's natural and normal to feel unprotected if we don't have that kind of protection and feeling of openness coming from the devotees. It's very important. When we take instruction, we're also taking shelter of devotees. We're not just hearing philosophy from them, we're personally expecting them to care for us, to help our little weak creeper develop and grow. And those are just some thoughts. You probably have some better thoughts than I do.
So
As you also giving the example in GBC meetings this year, that it's going to be very good, like a father doing things out in the world, but it's been so good as being a mother and looking after the people at home.
Yeah, the concept of father and mother is often raised. That one has to be father and mother to people that are new to Krishna consciousness. And the fatherly idea is that you just go out and you make a lot of money and you're building up the dynasty of the empire and you're successful in your preaching. And the mother is the nurturer. The mother is the one who makes sure that you are a stable person, that you're moral and that you feel that you're cared for. We were advising this one family that they should have a family day. They totally family instead of just preaching. Otherwise the children wouldn't feel that their parents really cared for them. And it worked. It was very good for them. It was good for their Krishna consciousness. So that whole social development, this whole series of social development issues of bonding and support groups and women and children and education are the infrastructure upon which one has to build. If there's no infrastructure, obviously there's not going to be a structure. Just like your temple over here, if you didn't have some very solid, whatever the infrastructure was, metal beams, then you couldn't put the concrete around, then you couldn't have a temple. So as we've grown, as was kind of indirectly pointed out, we've been very monastic movement. Just the temples with a few people. Now most of the initiated devotees aren't living in the temples. The instruction is we should preach with the courage of a British soldier and the heart of a Bengali mother. So it's kind of all there, you know. Little aphorisms you can find in Prabhupada's head, but very important things. There's great affection is required to preach.
Maharaj, towards the end of Dr. Hopkins' writing, he mentioned that there was a large expansion of the Hindu religious.
Yeah.
But at this time, he used the word openness, and he has problems. I'm just wondering, is that going to be difficult for ISKCON in one way, because there's such a disparity, such a growing expansion of the Hindu culture in different ways?
Yeah, it'll definitely be a difficulty because one faces this cultural difference just like our temple of Tonga is like this temple. Our congregation are mainly from the Indian community, and yet we're living in a community of non-Indian. So sometimes there's a conflict between, you get a whole group of people and there's a whole group of other people that have a different culture than we do. So we have to learn how to not only bridge the two cultures, but how to reach out with Krishna consciousness so that both cultures feel very supported and very protected and very very much able to advance in Krishna consciousness. It's a challenge that we have to face. And the more we see that it's there, and the more we deal with it in a very mature and enlightened way, the better it will be.
In Auckland there are so many different Hindu temples. We were the first temple here, and we were presenting Krishna consciousness.
Right.
But now we've got so much
competition,
demigod worship.
Yeah.
it's expanding very quickly.
Yeah. We have to be confident that we aren't really competing, because in the most important sense, the Krishna consciousness movement makes all other attempts irrelevant. We have to really understand that we have something to offer. Prabhupada has something to offer, which no other temple or other organization, Indian or non-Indian, has to offer. And we have to build upon those strengths, those things that we have to offer. Prasada, direct connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Prabhupada himself, and his followers, and his movement, and his books. That makes the competition irrelevant. We have to understand that that's the case. So I have one more question, and then I'm about to go. Yes.
When I was speaking about the Hindu, in fact, you know that ISKCON is specially for Hindu.
Spiritually?
It's not specially for Hindu, so it's for everyone.
It's for everyone,
so,
right?
I just remember sometime I was in Mauritius, and devotees used to go to house when there was only a red flag. So they say, oh, Hindu. But because we have white skins, that was already there, we are doing it everywhere, to Chinese, to Muslims, to Christian. But if we just stay on the Hindu, I mean, if we just think, oh, we are going to lose all this Hindu stuff, we are just to try to preach more everyone.
Yeah, of course we have to understand also other people and their cultures and what their needs and concerns and interests are, and take that into account according to time, place, and circumstance. So many things when we preach. So it's a challenge because it's not a simple matter. Preaching is an art, and an art is not very narrow and doctrinaire. It's very fluid, and it requires a very deep understanding. Anyway, I'll continue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hare Krishna.